Respected guests, friends, young people, and brothers and sisters. Christadelphians today owe their existence to a couple of 19th century Bible students named John Thomas and Robert Roberts. During that great religious reform period, which brought so many revolutionary ideas to light and spawned countless churches, such as the Church of Christ, the Seventh-day Adventists, the Jehovah's Witnesses, the Church of God of the Abrahamic Covenant, and many, many others, this revolution was brought on by the religious freedom that men experienced in these United States in the 18th and 19th centuries, a freedom which then spread across Europe. But of all the religious writers of that era, these men alone had the clarity to see through the fogs and the confusions of the state religions of the time and give a rebirth to the truth as it is in Jesus in these latter days. And perhaps the most fascinating aspect of their work was their work with Bible prophecy. The clarity that they had of scriptural prophecy makes their work both captivating and accurate to this very day. We were speaking at the start of this week with Brother Sid Jones from Canada, who observed that if Brethren Thomas and Roberts were alive today, they would be telling us that with all that we see going on around us, we are not nearly excited enough. And Brother Sid is right. We are not nearly excited enough because it is impossible not to see on a monthly or nearly even a daily basis the fulfillment of God's plan of salvation as exhibited in the prophecies of the Bible and explained in the writings of this men. The fact is that Christ is at the door. Our principal book for examination this week has been Ezekiel. So this evening we will focus our attention on the prophecies from this book, not just because that is what we have been studying all week, but because it is the most appropriate book from which to examine the current events of the past few weeks. In 1971, while still governor of California, Ronald Reagan attended a banquet given in honor of a California state senator named James Mills. After the main course, he asked Mr. Mills if he was familiar with, quoting Mr. Reagan now, the fierce Old Testament prophet Ezekiel. He went on to explain that Russia was the Magog described in Ezekiel's prophecy and was thus doomed to destruction. Mr. Reagan said, in the 38th chapter of Ezekiel, it says, God will take the children of Israel from among the heathen where they had been scattered and will gather them again in the promised land. Ezekiel says that the nation that will lead all men and lead all the other powers into darkness against Israel will come out of the north. What other powerful nation is north of Israel besides Russia? None. But it didn't seem to make much sense before the Russian Revolution when Russia was a Christian country. Now it does. Now that Russia has become a communist and atheistic, now that Russia has set itself against God, now it fits the description perfectly. Reagan conceded that everything hasn't fallen into place yet, but he strongly believed the end of the Soviet Empire and the second coming of Christ were close at hand. Well, let's look at this 38th chapter of Ezekiel, and we can see what Mr. Reagan got right and on what points he failed to connect. The chapter reads in Ezekiel 38, verses 1 through 3, and the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Son of man, set thy face against Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against him, and say, Thus saith Adonai Yahweh, Behold, I am against thee, O Gog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya with them, all of them with shield and helmet. Gomer and all his bands, the house of Togarmah of the north quarters and all his bands, and many people with thee. And the revised version there, instead of using chief priest in that chief prince in that first quote, leaves the word untranslated as a proper noun and uses the word Rosh. Now, what a bunch of funny names. How can we make any sense out of these things? Who are these peoples? Well, it turns out that all these names except Gog, are names of countries and are listed among the nations of Genesis 10. And they are also listed by man's historians from antiquity. Following the Tower of Babel, as the nations migrated across Europe, they settled by tribes in different regions of the earth. Ancient historians, such as Herodotus, have traced the movements of these people and have found these things. Magog and Gomer were dominant tribes as they moved across Europe. They spread themselves across the Danube, the river which splits Europe into northern and southern sections. The descendants of Magog settled north of the Danube and became the people we know as the Germans or Germanic tribes, not the Russians, as Mr. Reagan suggested. While the descendants of Gomer became the people of the French and settled south of the Danube. So the chief constituents of this northern power are the German and French peoples, or simply the peoples of continental Europe. But Mr. Reagan was correct in one thing, that Russia was the great power of the north, named by Ezekiel. Rosh, the word translated chief prince there, Rosh is the earliest known name of Russia. We first learned that the river through the modern Kiev was called the River Ross. And the following is from the Encyclopedia Britannica. The Russian Belaya Tserkov, the city, the Kiev Oblast, north central Ukraine on the Ross River, founded in the 11th century, Bela Tserkov, or White Church, long remained a minor regional center. In modern times, industry has developed, including machine building, tire production, furniture making, canning, flour milling, and the making of knitwear. A feature of the city is its large park, landscaped in the 18th century, and contains many exotic botanical species. The city has an agricultural institute, etc. And we further learn of this name, Rus, also spelled Ross, as an ancient people who gave their name to the land of Russia. Their origin and identity are very much in dispute. Traditional Western scholars believe them to be Scandinavian Vikings, an offshoot of the Varangians, who moved southward from the Baltic coast and founded the first consolidated state among the Eastern Slavs, centering on the Kiev. Russian scholars, along with some Westerns, considered the Rus to be a southeastern Slavic tribe. They founded a tribal league, the Kievan State. They affirm was the creation of Slavs, and was attacked and held only briefly by the Varangians. Russian scholars have insisted that Eastern Slavs, before the entry of Varangians, had evolved a sophisticated feudal state comparable to the Carolingian Empire in the West. The Rus were simply a southern Slavic tribe living on the Ross River. So there can be no question who the people of Ross are, and no question who this king of the north will be. They are the very people we are reading about in our daily newspapers right now, this week. They are the people being attacked in the American press since this last Monday when we were on our ways down to high, as unjustly interfering in the American election. They are the people, some of whom are of the nation formerly called Kiev Rus, or today the Ukraine. The Ukraine, some of which Russia has recently annexed to herself in Crimea as recently as 2014. And this is where we see the hand of God at work in human affairs when we think about places like the Ukraine. In 1990, while George H.W. Bush was president, that would be George Bush the Elder, the Soviet Union fell apart. Many of the states like Chechnya and Georgia and the Ukraine had received independence from the Soviet Union. These independent states immediately saw the need to join the various organizations of the world which would protect them from Russian expansionist goals. They knew from the outset that Russia had only stepped back from the world stage. and would someday again emerge to try and build an empire. So they all sought membership in the various organizations like NATO to join in the defense pact against Russia, and in the European Union to make stronger economic ties with the West rather than to be so dependent upon Russia. But for whatever reason, and we know the reason was the hand of God, the Western states did not grasp the seriousness of their plight. They seemed to believe that Russia, out of the goodness of her heart, had stepped back from empire. It wasn't that way. It was because the military policies of Ronald Reagan had driven the Soviet Union into bankruptcy. In the 1980s, before the decline of the Soviet Union, the Soviet Union's economy had a gross national product of about $1 trillion. And the American economy at that time was about $3 trillion. Might be hard to imagine numbers that small, but that's what they were. The Soviets were outspending the Americans on defense and had developed an army large enough to threaten the West. Nearly every commander of NATO, and by law, NATO must always be led by an American general called the Supreme Allied Commander. Nearly every commander of NATO, when asked what to do if the Soviets advanced into Europe, said all that he could do was fight for 3 days and go nuclear. Russia was that powerful. In the 1980s, Ronald Reagan had become president, and he stepped up the arms race. He increased the U.S. defense spending greatly, taking spending up to $300 billion a year. The Soviet Union tried to match him. But the U.S. was spending $300 billion a year out of a $3 trillion economy, or about 10%, where the Soviets began spending $300 billion out of a $1 trillion economy, or 30%, on defense. The Soviets soon ran out of money, and this brought extreme discontent in Russia. Dissatisfied workers produced poor quality goods, which, as one former Soviet worker once observed, they pretended to pay us and we pretended to work. And soon it was obvious that this effort of empire building on the part of Russia had failed. So the Soviet Union collapsed because of its ambition. But not understanding that it was only bankruptcy which had ended the empire, and then only temporarily, it was not a change of heart in Russian leadership. Western leaders were slow to encourage the now free states to join the West. George H.W. Bush even went to Kiev in 1991, the capital of Ukraine, and delivered what history now looks back on as his Chicken Kiev speech, after the fried chicken recipe of that name, in which he argued against the formation of an independent Ukrainian state separate from Russia. Efforts to join the European Union were similarly discouraged or taken at such a snail's pace that not very much happened. And this unwillingness to embrace these breakaway republics have made it possible for a man like President Putin to begin to put his empire back together again. But Putin today, in the recent times, has lacked much of an army. So he is moving slowly but persistently, and only when the West will not engage him. For instance, in August of 2008, Putin marched his troops into Georgia of the former Soviet Union. His pretense, curiously, for going into Georgia was that Russian natives were being persecuted by the Georgian population, which is identically the same excuse he used to go into Ukraine and the same noise that he makes about the northern states in Latvia and Estonia. The United States at the time was war-weary from two major wars in Iraq. And Putin was gambling that the U.S., with an increasingly unpopular and soon-to-be-replaced president, that would be George Bush the Younger, would not engage him. But this turned out to be wrong. When Putin marched into Georgia, the U.S., which had a battle cruiser permanently stationed in the Black Sea in those days, moved a destroyer and a command ship into the Mediterranean, or from the Mediterranean fleet, the USS Mount Whitney, into the Black Sea. When Russia refused to retreat, the Mount Whitney sailed into the harbor at Tbilisi, into the heart of the Russian Black Sea Navy, which had blockaded the port. Russia then pulled back to South Ossetia, a northern part of Georgia, and waited for the next administration. When it came, Russia annexed South Ossetia with barely a comment anywhere and put enough pressure on the rest of Georgia to change the direction of the government from looking toward the west to its direction, for its direction, to looking back towards Russia. But that war had a serious and unintended consequence for Russia. It helped Europe understand a real threat to them at the time, that Russia was, and it made them more willing to accept an American missile defense program stationed in Poland. And plans were finalized to put this into play. But when the Obama administration came to power and wanted to reset relationships with Russia, which Putin was only too glad to do, this program was reneged on by the United States. So in spite of this tremendous opportunity given the West to permanently isolate Russia, they let that opportunity, or rather, God made that opportunity to slip through their hands, that God's plan would be secured. Today, we see Russia continuing to work in the old Soviet states. We see him threatening the states with oil and gas. We have seen Russia engage in two wars in Chechnya and annexing them to Russia. We see Georgia to the south, who was attacked and partially conquered by Putin in 2008, as we just mentioned. And we see Crimea and the Ukraine annexed to Russia. Belarus is one of the states which had their gas and oil threatened to be cut off if they didn't yield to Russian pressure. Estonia and Latvia and Lithuania all fear Russian invasion. And this is exactly what Ezekiel 38 tells us Russia will do. So it is an alliance of European states led by Russia which comes down against the Middle East, according to the 38th chapter of Ezekiel. And that is exactly what we see forming today. Now, when Russia moves into the Middle East, she will be met by a foe the scriptures calls the ships of Tarshish with all her young lions. Who is this great foe and defender of Israel? And it is a mighty foe. So mighty that we should go back and look at the fourth verse of the 38th chapter. God says to Russia, "And I will turn thee back and put hooks into thy jaws, and I will bring thee forth and all thine army, horses and horsemen, all of them clothed in all sorts of armor, even a great company with bucklers and shields, all of them handling swords. The nations set for the defense of Israel is powerful enough that God can use them to turn back the Russian invasion when it first comes into the land. In fact, this invasion is probably turned back twice. For whether we look at the invasion of Jerusalem in 604 under Nebuchadnezzar the Great, or the invasion of Jerusalem by the Syrians in the classical Greek wars of the first 2 centuries B.C., or if we look at the destruction of Jerusalem in 87 by the Romans, there are always two invasions of Jerusalem which ends with varying results, and then an ultimate destruction of Jerusalem with the third advance. So when God tells Russia that he will turn them back and bring them forth, he is telling us that there must be a force in the earth powerful enough for God to use to defeat the Russian invader when it comes into the land. In other words, God is telling us that there must be a Tarshish. Now I want you to note here that the Tarshish powers say, "Art thou come to take a spoil?" You see, Tarshish is in the land of Israel, set for the defense, for the defense of Israel. The northern power is coming to them. It is not, "Art thou gone in there to take a spoil," such as an observing nation might say. No, it's, "Art thou come to take a spoil?" So this Tarshish nation has a very specific and important role to play in the time of the end. The prophet Ezekiel tells us a lot about this Tarshish and its capital city, Tyre. To Tyre, Ezekiel said in Ezekiel 27:12, "Tarshish was thy merchant by reason of the multitude of all kinds of riches. With silver, iron, tin, lead, they traded in thy fairs." And again in Ezekiel 27:25, "The ships of Tarshish did sing of thee in thy market, and thou was replenished. and made very glorious in the midst of the seas. In antiquity, that is, around 1,000 years before the birth of Christ, Tyre had become a mighty seafaring nation-state of Tyre and Sidon. They are the Tyre and Sidon that the Scriptures introduce us to. The first mention of them is during the period of Kings, where Hiram, king of Tyre, is mentioned as a great friend of David, so much so that Solomon and Hiram II eventually worked together in building the temple. Brother Thomas takes this relationship between David and Hiram and Solomon and Hiram II and argues that this relationship typified the relationship at the time of the end, where the Tarshish Tyre state will be called upon to protect Israel. He points out in Ezekiel 28:14 that Tyre is referred to this way: "Thou art the anointed cherub that covereth, and I have set thee so. Thou wast upon the holy mountain of God. Thou hast walked up and down in the midst of the stones of fire." Tyre in the King James Version is called the anointed cherub that covereth. Brother Thomas reasoned that that word anointed is better translated spreading or reaching out. So the Tyre-Tarshish state is a nation with a force in the Middle East covering Israel, spreading out its wings over Israel as the cherub spread its wings over the mercy seat, such as we have examined in our study classes of Ezekiel this week. And Brother Thomas drew similar conclusions concerning Tarshish from Isaiah 18 and 1. He translated that verse this way: "Ho, land of widely overshadowing wings, extending from beyond the rivers of Cush, which sendeth by sea whirling things, even upon vessels of fleetness on the surface of waters, go swiftly, ye messengers, to a nation carried away and oppressed, to a people terrible from this and onward, a nation prostrate and trodden down, whose lands the rivers have spoiled." The cushion there was the original Cush, which would be the modern-day Iraq. So from beyond the rivers of Iraq would be the nation, modern nation today of Afghanistan. And did anyone notice the American president earlier this month, on July 6th, said that he would keep 8,400 American troops in Afghanistan through the end of his administration, reneging on a campaign promise to end American involvement in Afghanistan? He would have loved to have removed all American influence from the region, but for some reason he found his hands tied and he abandoned plans to leave the area. From here, Tarshish would spread its wings widely overshadowing the land of Israel. From these two prophecies, one of Tarshish, one of Tyre, Brother Thomas concluded, "The decree has long gone forth which calls upon the Lion of Tarshish to protect the Jews." Now the invasion of their country, and still quoting Brother Thomas, "Now the invasion of their country by a spoiler at eventide who robs them implies a previous return." In other words, in order for Russia to come down against Israel, Israel must have returned to the land. He was writing in the middle 1800s, and of course Israel didn't return to the land until beginning in 1917 and becoming a nation in 1948. This finished colonization, Isaiah styles, a present unto the Lord of hosts of a people scattered and peeled. For speaking of the time of the end, he says, "In that time shall the present be brought to the Lord of hosts of a people scattered and peeled, to a place of the name of the Lord of hosts, the Mount Zion." But then the question returns upon us, by whom is the present to be made? The prophet answers this question in the first verse, saying, "Ho to the land shadowing with wings, which is beyond the rivers of Cush, that sendeth by sea whirling things," etc., the verse I just read. Now, geography of this passage points to the lion power of Tarshish as the land shadowing with wings. Later on in that same article, Brother Thomas makes this observation about the lion power. He says, "As I have said elsewhere, the lion power will not interest itself in behalf of the subject of God's kingdom from pure generosity or piety towards God or love of Israel, but upon the principles which actuate all the governments of the world, upon, namely, of the lust of dominion, self-preservation, and self-aggrandizement." Those are the principles which bring the Tarshish states into Israel. So the prophecies of Ezekiel cause us to consider, what is this great city-state with its mighty navy? And does it exist today so that this force will be able now, today, to defend Israel when the Russian hosts with their European allies descend into Israel? Tyre in the ancient world had become the richest nation of all. While not the military power of Assyria, Babylon, or Egypt, and not expanding its wealth through conquest like many of the more notable nations of antiquity, it generated its wealth as a great mercantile nation situated on the coast of Lebanon. This wealth had an evil effect on it, as it does most nations and on most individuals. Wealth has a special corrupting influence. It develops arrogance and pride. It comes with all the vices that the flesh can imagine. It removes God far from its mind. And we can clearly answer, yes, there is a group of nations today who answers the description of Tyre and the ships of Tarshish with all their young lions. These states are the English-speaking nations of the world, the United Kingdom or Britain, the United States, Canada, and Australasia. These states, far and away, make the richest alliance of states in all the world. The strength of their combined navies pitifully dwarfs the rest of all the rest of the navies of the world. It's probably almost five times greater. They combine to be the greatest trading nation of the world. And for over 100 years, they have combined to be the protectorate of Israel. And today, through the defense systems built and paid for by these English-speaking states, like the Iron Dome, and through the fleets permanently stationed in the Mediterranean Sea, which is known historically as the Sea of Tarshish, and also the fleets permanently stationed in the Persian Gulf and in the Indian Ocean, these English-speaking states continue to guarantee the existence of Israel. So yes, today as we speak, there is a Tarshish Tyre power in the world set for the defense of Israel. Now, most of the rest of the prophecies of Ezekiel deal with the destruction of that mother of city of Tyre on the coast of Lebanon. That Tyre eventually betrays her relationship with Israel and is subsequently destroyed, first by Babylon and finally by Alexander the Great, so that the Tyre we see existing on a map today is not the ancient Tyre. That one is covered by the Mediterranean Sea. But Tyre comes to stand as a prophetic symbol relevant to these latter days. Tyre, the nation symbolized by that name, come to stand for the wealthy power that will again support Israel in the latter days. In fact, we read in the Psalms of that great day when Jesus shall stand in Jerusalem, having defeated that northern king, and the daughter of Tyre shall be there with a gift. Even the rich among the people shall entreat thy favor. So to be able to bring gifts to David's greater son, Tyre must recover from her wounds, which is also part of the Bible prophecy concerning Tyre. In Isaiah 23, we read this about Tyre and its desolation and its rebirth. Howl, ye ships of Tarshish, for your strength is laid waste. And it shall come to pass in that day that Tyre shall be forgotten 70 years, according to the days of one king. After the end of 70 years, Tyre shall sing as a harlot. Take in heart, go about the city, thou harlot, thou hast been forgotten. Make sweet melody, sing many songs, that thou mayest be remembered. And it shall come to pass that after the end of 70 years, the Lord will visit Tyre, and she shall turn to her hire, and shall commit fornication with the kingdoms of the world and upon the face of the earth. Now, the primary application of this prophecy, we know that Tyre was destroyed by Babylon, and that the time of the Babylonian kingdom existed was for 70 years, from 604 BC to 534 BC. During this time, Tyre was supportive of the northern king, then represented by Babylon, until Babylon destroyed her. When Cyrus the Great conquered Babylon, he crowned himself king of Babylon in 534 BC, and he released many nations from their Babylonian chains, and this included the Jews who returned to Israel under Zerubbabel. But he also freed Tyre, who grew again into a great trading power of the world. As the prophecy said, when the 70 years were expired, Tyre again grew so great that Alexander could not resist stopping to rob her as he came into the east, Middle East, with his Greek armies. So we stop to consider, what have we seen within this last month as applicable to this city of Tyre? Among the richest, and some might say the richest city in the world, is London. London certainly is among the cities to be considered the latter-day Tyre. But for years and years now, certainly for all my adult life, and even when I was a young child, the brethren have been observing that London, or Britain, is out of their proper role for Bible prophecy. Britain started out well, first by ending the seven times of punishment promised to Israel due to their disobedience to divine precept. We learn here in a very powerful way that Yahweh is still working out his plan of salvation with the Jews. He told them that they would be trodden down of the Gentiles till the times of the Gentiles would be fulfilled. And Yahweh had warned them that for their disobedience, they would be punished seven times. We read in Leviticus 26 at verse 17, "And I will set my face against you, and ye shall be slain before your enemies. They that hate you shall reign over you, and ye shall flee when none pursueth you." This is Yahweh speaking to Israel. "And if ye will not for all this hearken unto me, I will punish you seven times more for your sins." Now, the term time is very significant in Bible prophecy. It signifies the time it takes for a year to be completed. To the ancients, this was 360 days, or 12 months of 30 days. And it is why our circle today is said to have 360 degrees. This was considered to be a time. Israel, through the law, was said to be punished seven times for their sins. Well, seven times 360 is 2,520. So we find that the time for the treading down of Jerusalem by the Gentiles was to be 2,520 years. What was it? Well, if we add 2520 to the 604 BC, we said was the time when Nebuchadnezzar conquered Israel, we come to 1916. But in archaeology, there is no year zero. In archaeology, we go directly from 1 BC to 1 AD. So we have to add an additional year to our calculation anytime we cross this time frame. And that brings us to 1917. But what significant event happened in 1917 during World War I? Of course, that is the year Jerusalem was freed by the Turks. When on December 11th, the British General Allenby marched into the city of Jerusalem, freeing them from the domination by their foes. So December 11, 1917, exactly seven times or 2,520 years later, Jerusalem was freed from all vestiges of the nations represented by Nebuchadnezzar's image. In fact, the magazine called Bible Archaeology Today, which is in no way a friend to the Bible, spends most of their time with archaeology trying to disprove the Bible. They say that Nebuchadnezzar conquered Jerusalem in the winter of 604 BC, just as was General Allenby's entrance into the city of December 1917. It is notable as to just how exact Yahweh is with his word. It was also in 1917, under the direction of British Prime Minister David Lloyd George, along with Lord Arthur Balfour, that Britain issued the Balfour Declaration, a declaration intended to establish a homeland for the Jews in Israel. But as the trials of the region drew on, by the 1940s, Britain had wearied of the fight, and fearful of upsetting the Arabs and losing the Arab oil necessary for her own economy, Britain had withdrawn or begun to withdraw from the region. In 1957, she even adopted, through a white paper issued by Duncan Sandys, who was the British Defense Minister, an official policy called West of Gibraltar, where Britain said they would not intervene in the Middle East or even in the Mediterranean, keeping their forces west of the Rock of Gibraltar, the eastern entrance of the Mediterranean Sea. She could not control the Sea of Tarshish, as she refused to sail into the Sea of Tarshish. In the years following this withdrawal, Britain grew closer to Europe. in 1960. They entered into a free trade agreement, which was the fledgling group that eventually became the European Union. I recall as a very young boy watching the brethren speaking of being horrified of that. I didn't understand it, of course, but I knew whatever it was bad. But it got much worse. In 1975, Britain joined the common market with Europe. And in 1999, they joined the European Union, bringing their civil society under the control of Brussels. All these things exhibited an anti-typical tire moving in the wrong direction. What have we seen now in just this past month? In this past month, on June 26th, the British people voted to end this long association with Europe, the Magog and Gomer of Ezekiel 38, and move in a different direction, exactly as Bible prophecy said had to happen. The vote, called the Vote for the British Exit of the European Union, or Brexit for short, gave the people of Britain the choice, and they chose to reverse the course of their leaders, against the advice of their leaders, and take their rightful place on the world stage, away from the closest association with Catholic continental Europe. The wise money people of the world had bet 5-1 that Brexit would fail. But to the shock of the world, though not the Bible students, it passed. We couldn't say how Britain would disengage from Catholic Europe, but we knew they must. And this vote gave Britain the chance, and they took it. Now, we spoke just a few minutes ago about Isaiah's prophecy of Tyre being suppressed for 70 years, the length of the Babylonian captivity, where Tyre's hire went to Babylon till Babylon destroyed her, and then she was reborn. Well, perhaps it is no coincidence that Britain's lowest point in its relationship with Israel happened nearly 70 years to the day of the Brexit vote. The lowest point in British-Jewish relationships was reached in 1946. Believing that Britain was working for the overthrow of Israel near the end of the British Mandate, Israel had intensified its raids against British troops and against British installations, blowing up 11 bridges in one night, a night called the Night of Bridges, and the interrupted train travel throughout all Palestine. British soldiers were kidnapped and held in exchange for Irgun prisoners. Irgun was a special illegal police force which Israel had put together, which essentially was a terrorist group aimed at Britain. And some of the British soldiers were hung because their demands were not met. To end the turmoil, Britain invaded Israel June 29, 1946, in what the British called Operation Agatha, but what the Jews called Black Sabbath. Britain admits to an invading force of 17,000 regular soldiers, 2,500 civil policemen invading at that time. Israel claims that the invading force was nearly 100,000 men. 2,700 Jews were arrested, including all the Jewish leaders but two, David Ben-Gurion, who was out of the country, and Golda Meir, who sat in her office waiting to be arrested but wasn't. And the offices of the Jewish Agency in Haganah were raided, and the files were taken back to the British headquarters of the at the King David Hotel. The files were going to be used and reread to determine who was doing the illegal activities in Irgun and in the Stern Gang, which was another illegal police force. And they intended to prosecute those responsible. Israel could not allow those files to be seen. So 2 weeks later, the Irgun, led by future Prime Minister Menachem Begin, blew up the British headquarters at the King David Hotel, killing 91 and wounding 46 more, destroying all those papers so dangerous to Israel's future. This invasion and this low point in the history between Britain and Israel took place June 29, 1946. The Brexit vote took place 70 years later, nearly to the day, June 26, 2016. And with that vote came a new prime minister. David Cameron, having led the opposition to Brexit, he was the former prime minister, said it would be inappropriate for him to preside over the breakout from the European Union. And so a new prime minister was to be voted in, and that is Theresa Day. So what does this mean for British-Israeli relationships in the future? The following is from Haaretz, perhaps Israel's most critical paper of foreign states. It says this about the new prime minister. What does this mean for Israel and UK's Jewish community? The new prime minister is certainly well-versed on the threats facing the Jewish community in both the UK and around the world. Indeed, Theresa has been a firm and consistent friend of the Jewish community and Israel. And I believe she will continue to stand up for the Jews and the Jewish state as prime minister. Theresa May already has a strong relationship with UK's Jewish community, having addressed a number of major communal events. She played a prominent role in reassuring the UK's Jewish community in the immediate aftermath of the horrific Charlie Hebdo and Hypercacher attacks in January 2015. She asserted that without its Jews, Britain would not be Britain, and attended a high-profile rally to jointly declare with the community, "Je suis juif," I am Jewish. She is not Jewish. She was just expressing her solidarity with the Jews. She also has repeatedly stressed that Israel had the right to defend itself, a policy opposed by the European Union and even some not-so-distant official British governments. One thing I observed that was quite notable in the recent choice for prime minister was that all the candidates for prime minister seemed to be cut out of the same cloth. All were individuals who were openly pro-Israel. And that still leaves the Tarshish states entwined in Catholic Europe in certain organizations such as NATO, a defense mechanism for the defense of Europe against Russian aggression. The United States, the United Kingdom, and Canada are all NATO states. Now Russia is right now as we speak, getting hammered in the U.S. press, as we said at the start of this lecture, for being involved in the upcoming U.S. election. At the start of this week, while we were on our way down here to High, WikiLeaks, which is an organization that publishes hacked or illegally obtained computer data, WikiLeaks published 30,000 emails which had been stolen from the Democratic National Committee, which is, of course, the head of the U.S. Democratic Party. These emails showed the bias in place in favor of the former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in her race against Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. Among the things that these emails shows was the bigotry of the DNC against Sanders by reason of his being Jewish. To counter this embarrassment, the DNC is claiming that the hack was done by the Russians to embarrass Secretary Clinton in a race for presidency. They claim that President Putin, Vladimir Putin of Russia, wants Donald Trump to win the presidency because Mr. Trump has promised that if he wins, he will get the United States first out of NATO, or he will insist that the fellow states pay their fair share. And if they don't, he says, the U.S. will opt out of NATO. The United States, along with the United Kingdom and Canada, is in cooperation with the Northern European Catholic states in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. This cannot be true at the time of the end. Europe must be completely in the fold of Russia, not aligned with the Tarshish states. This alliance could easily break down by force of circumstances. When the Tarshish states and Europe end up fighting each other, as prophesied in Ezekiel 38, then obviously NATO will cease to exist. But it is notable that the current Republican candidate for president has, for the first time from either party, recommended getting out of NATO, which after he was challenged, he modified to be making NATO pay their fair share, which would have the same effect of ending NATO. Every president since Ronald Reagan has been demanding that the European states increase their spending for military, and instead they have all been reducing it. There are 28 countries in NATO. Apologists for NATO say that the United States pays the most, but still only pays 22% of the NATO budget, which is true, But that budget, like most budgets, doesn't tell the whole story. NATO has what is called indirect costs, which would include things like armaments and other costs required in an emergency not budgeted for. I'm sure that everyone would agree that it's hard to budget for wars in advance. The U.S. pays almost all of this cost. When the budgeted costs of NATO along with the indirect costs are combined, the U.S. pays 73% of NATO's budget. Obviously, any president concerned with runaway expenses would be looking here as a possible place to cut. So the point we wish to make this evening, and which we wish to make clear, is that God is now rapidly lining up the nations to set them in array against each other and to bring the return of Christ to defeat both and to rule on this very earth. He will intervene between these combatants, defeat all opposition to himself, and rule the earth in peace. We should all make ourselves as ready as we can against that great day. Now, we'd normally end the lecture here with some final thoughts on what we covered, but I was asked if I could include a couple of questions related to current events in this talk this evening, and I really couldn't figure out a way to work them in, so I thought I would just try and quickly answer a couple of questions here at the end. The first was, why will the Arabs accept Christ first? And the answer to that is simple. The Arabs will be the first to accept Christ because they will be the first to feel his sword. Think about the Arabs, or perhaps more accurately, the Muslim world today. It is divided into two religious groups, the Sunni Muslims to the south and the Shiite Muslims of Iran, Iraq, and Syria in the north. The Sunni Muslims are the Sheba and Dedan of Ezekiel 38. Next slide, please. Next slide, there we go. That's shown in green. And they fight alongside of the Tarshish powers, according to Ezekiel 38. The Shiites in the red states immediately above the green join the northern invaders on the sides of Russia. We didn't discuss the war itself this evening, but in the war, after Tarshish has turned back the Russian forces, the east wind blows against the ships of Tarshish, destroying them. Brother Thomas thought this would be the natural forces of winds and waves, and I would add volcanoes, which will sink the Tarshish war machine. Psalms 48:7 tells us, "Thou breakest the ships of Tarshish with an east wind." The destruction of that great Tarshish navy I spoke of earlier provides the opening that Russia needs to rush down onto the mountains of Israel, destroying Israel as we know it today. And of course, when this happens, the southern Arabs end up conquered by the northern Arabs, their civil and religious enemy. Some might remember a few years ago when on the battlefield in Syria, a Sunni Muslim commander cut open a Shiite commander and ate the insides on the battlefield. That's how much these two religions hate each other. Habakkuk said in Habakkuk 3, 7 and 8, "I saw the tents of Cushan in affliction, and the curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. Was Yahweh displeased against the rivers? Was thine anger against the rivers? Was thy wrath against the sea, that thou didst ride upon thine horses and thy chariots to salvation?" It is Christ and the saints riding into Cushan and Midian, by the slide there represented in purple, before engaging the Russia, who has for a short time obtained the victory over Jerusalem. And that is the way he conquers the southern Arab states. And in doing so, he delivers them from their hated northern enemy. Then, as the work of the saints causes the deserts to blossom as a rose, these Arabs recognize the righteousness of the invading force and submit to the rule of Christ and the saints. So the answer is, they submit to the rule of Christ first because they're the first to feel his sword. The second question I was asked to address was by Brother Sid, who asked, why is it that the churches look for a 7 years of tribulation period for the earth? And what prophecy do they get that from when they speak about their doctrine of the rapture? They do so using an illogical and impossible method of interpretation. And not surprisingly then, they come up with an illogical and impossible theory they call rapture. It comes about from the result of trying to unravel the prophecy of 70 weeks, which Brother Curtis spoke to us about. Brother Curtis mentioned that there are several different ways of calculating this date. He had used the numbers from Brother Thomas, who concluded that Jesus was logically born in year 0, and therefore must have been crucified in the year 33 AD. He simply subtracted 490 from 33 and reached the date 456 BC, or sometimes 457 BC, which was the date I believe Curtis used. He then concluded that 457 BC was the 20th of Artaxerxes, when the command to build the walls of Jerusalem were issued by King Artaxerxes Longimanus. Isaac Newton, obviously, was a mathematician, arguably the greatest mathematician that ever lived. And he calculated the dates of these kings based on eclipses and other astronomical data recorded in history. He knew from astronomical data that the first of Artaxerxes was 465 to 464 BC. And so the 20th year of Artaxerxes' reign then would be 444, making the 490 years end at 46 BC, which, as we know, would be much too late for the date of the crucifixion. Newton, therefore, chose the third scripturally recorded Persian decree, that in the 7th of Artaxerxes, carried out by Ezra, and returning to the land from Babylon and reestablishing temple worship. His date for the start of the 70 weeks, then, was 457, the same as Brother Thomas. And accounting for the year 0, he had the crucifixion at 34 AD. Newton's date required Jesus to be much older than the traditional 33 and a half at his crucifixion. Herod died in 4 BC, which is also astronomically fixed. So Jesus had to be born before 4 BC. And in order for the wise men to have visited him looking for the child, Jesus, it had to be even perhaps a couple years before that. Most date the birth of Christ 2 years before the death of Herod. And this would make Christ nearly 40 years old at his death. Newton admitted to ignoring this fact, claiming that the dates for the birth of Christ are impossible to arrive at astronomically. As prophetic writers became dissatisfied with the age of Christ required by Newton's calculations, they began to look at the way Newton had broke down the prophecy in terms of 7 weeks of 49 years, and 62 weeks of 434 years, and then the final week for the crucifixion. Those following Newton concluded that that last week of 70 years had to be broken out of the 490 years altogether and applied to the return of Christ, not to the crucifixion of Christ, as both Brother Thomas and Isaac Newton had reasoned. Then Jesus could be crucified, according to Newton's general work, after 483 years, not after 490, at 33 and a half in AD 28. So that last week of 70 years is broken out and just randomly applied to some future time called the 7 years of tribulation. Some have Jesus rapturing the saints out of the world at the start of that last week, some in the midst or 3.5 years into the tribulation, and some at the end of the 7 weeks. And while this is more consistent with the types of the priesthood which would require Jesus to be 33.5 at his crucifixion, it is a ridiculous way to calculate prophecy and would only appear reasonable to those who can imagine such a doctrine as rapture in the first place. What can be the possible explanation for randomly tearing a portion of time off of a prophecy and applying it at some future random date? As for the date itself, the prophecy itself, we would suggest that the question was answered by the late German historian Arlo Peters. Peters concluded in his work that Artaxerxes was born 484, and he took the throne, as Newton said, at 19 years of age in 465 BC. The decree in the 20th of Artaxerxes refers to his age, not the year of his reign, which would be 464. If we add 490 to this, we come to the 26 AD. Adding 1 year for the year 0, we come to 27. Both Brother Thomas and Isaac Newton believed the crucifixion had to be on a Friday, and 27 AD would be a year when the Passover, the 14th of Abib, began Thursday evening and continued until Friday evening. So that would fit perfectly all of the requirements of that prophecy. But the main point is that the rapture doctrine is a false doctrine, and we need not be concerned with the world's superstitions concerning it. It came into existence as Catholicism looked for a way to explain the fact brought to light by virtually every Protestant reformer, from Peter Waldo to Martin Luther, that the Bible prophecies focus on the Catholic Church as the great enemy of God, who will join with that Russian Gog and Catholic Europe to descend upon the mountains of Israel. It will cause the world to see Jesus Christ, but identify him as the Antichrist, making the world fight against Christ and his saints, and allowing Christ and the saints to purge the world from all wickedness. May it be our lot to stand with Jesus and with those mighties of old in that great battle to establish the only true and lasting peace this world will ever know.